Chapter 3. When in doubt, tell the truth. Pudd'nhead Wilson's new calendar. About 4 days out from Victoria we plunged into hot weather, and all the male passengers put on white linen clothes. 1 or 2 days later we crossed the 25th parallel of north latitude, and then, by order, the officers of the ship laid away their blue uniforms, and came out in white linen ones. All the ladies were in white by this time. This prevalence of snowy costumes gave the promenade deck an invitingly cool, and cheerful and picnicky aspect. From my diary. There are several sorts of ills in the world from which a person can never escape altogether, let him journey as far as he will. One escapes from one breed of an ill, only to encounter another breed of it. We have come far from the snake liar and the fish liar, and there was rest, and peace in the thought. But now we have reached the realm of the boomerang liar, and sorrow is with us once more. The first officer has seen a man try to escape from his enemy, by getting behind a tree, but the enemy sent his boomerang sailing into the sky far above and beyond the tree, then it turned, descended, and killed the man. The Australian passenger has seen this thing done to two men, behind two trees and by the one arrow. This being received with a large silence that suggested doubt, he buttressed it with the statement that his brother once saw the boomerang kill a bird away off 100 yards, and bring it to the thrower. But these are ills which must be borne. There is no other way. The talk passed from the boomerang to dreams, usually a fruitful subject, afloat, or ashore, but this time the output was poor. Then it passed to instances of extraordinary memory with better results. Blind Tom, the Negro pianist, was spoken of, and it was said that he could accurately play any piece of music, howsoever long and difficult, after hearing it once, and that 6 months later he could accurately play it again, without having touched it in the interval. One of the most striking of the stories told was furnished by a gentleman who had served on the staff of the Viceroy of India. He read the details from his notebook, and explained that he had written them down, right after the consummation of the incident which they described, because he thought that, if he did not put them down in black and white, he might presently come to think he had dreamed them or invented them. The Viceroy was making a progress, and among the shows offered by the Maharaja of Mysore for his entertainment was a memory exhibition. The Viceroy and 30 gentlemen of his suite sat in a row, and the memory expert, a high caste Brahmin, was brought in and seated on the floor in front of them. He said he knew but 2 languages, the English and his own, but would not exclude any foreign tongue from the tests, to be applied to his memory. Then he laid before the assemblage his program, a sufficiently extraordinary one. He proposed that one gentleman should give him 1 word of a foreign sentence, and tell him its place in the sentence. He was furnished with the French word est, and was told it was second in a sentence of 3 words. The next gentleman gave him the German word Verlieren, and said it was the third in a sentence of 4 words. He asked the next gentleman for 1 detail in a sum in addition, another for 1 detail in a sum of subtraction, others for single details in mathematical problems of various kinds. He got them. Intermediates gave him single words from sentences in Greek, Latin, Spanish, Portuguese, Italian, and other languages, and told him their places in the sentences. When at last everybody had furnished him a single rack from a foreign sentence, or a figure from a problem, he went over the ground again, and got a second word and a second figure, and was told their places in the sentences and the sums, and so on and so on. He went over the ground again and again until he had collected all the parts of the sums, and all the parts of the sentences, and all in disorder, of course, not in their proper rotation. This had occupied 2 hours. The Brahmin now sat silent and thinking, a while, then began and repeated all the sentences, placing the words in their proper order, and untangled the disordered arithmetical problems, and gave accurate answers to them all. In the beginning he had asked the company to throw almonds at him during the 2 hours, he to remember how many each gentleman had thrown, but none were thrown, for the viceroy said that the test would be a sufficiently severe strain without adding that burden to it. General Grant had a fine memory for all kinds of things, including even names and faces, and I could have furnished an instance of it if I had thought of it. The first time I ever saw him was early in his first term as president. I had just arrived in Washington from the Pacific Coast, a stranger and wholly unknown to the public, and was passing the White House one morning when I met a friend, a senator from Nevada. He asked me if I would like to see the president. I said I should be very glad, so we entered. I supposed that the president would be in the midst of a crowd, and that I could look at him in peace and security from a distance, as another stray cat might look at another king. But it was in the morning, and the senator was using a privilege of his office which I had not heard of, the privilege of intruding upon the chief magistrate's working hours. Before I knew it, the senator and I were in the presence, and there was none there but we three. General Grant got slowly up from his table, put his pen down, and stood before me with the iron expression of a man who had not smiled for 7 years, and was not intending to smile for another seven. He looked me steadily in the eyes, mine lost confidence and fell. I had never confronted a great man before, and was in a miserable state of funk and inefficiency. The senator said, Mr. President, may I have the privilege of introducing Mr. Clemens? The president gave my hand an unsympathetic wag and dropped it. He did not say a word but just stood. In my trouble I could not think of anything to say, I merely wanted to resign. There was an awkward pause, a dreary pause, a horrible pause. Then I thought of something, and looked up into that unyielding face, and said timidly, Mr. President, I am embarrassed. Are you? His face broke just a little, a wee glimmer, the momentary flicker of a summer lightning smile, 7 years ahead of time, and I was out and gone, as soon as it was. 10 years passed away, before I saw him the second time. Meantime I was become better known, and was one of the people appointed to respond to toasts at the banquet given to General Grant in Chicago by the Army of the Tennessee, when he came back from his tour around the world. I arrived late at night, and got up late in the morning. All the corridors of the hotel were crowded with people waiting to get a glimpse of General Grant when he should pass to the place whence he was to review the great procession. I worked my way by the suite of packed drawing rooms, and at the corner of the house I found a window open, where there was a roomy platform decorated with flags, and carpeted. I stepped out on it, and saw below me millions of people blocking all the streets, and other millions caked together in all the windows, and on all the house tops around. These masses took me for General Grant, and broke into volcanic explosions and cheers. But it was a good place to see the procession, and I stayed. Presently I heard the distant blare of military music, and far up the street I saw the procession come in sight, cleaving its way through the huzzaing multitudes, with Sheridan, the most martial figure of the war, riding at its head in the dress uniform of a lieutenant general. And now General Grant, arm in arm with Major Carter Harrison, stepped out on the platform, followed two and two by the badged and uniformed reception committee. General Grant was looking exactly as he had looked upon that trying occasion of 10 years before, all iron and bronze self-possession. Mr. Harrison came over, and led me to the general and formally introduced me. Before I could put together the proper remark, General Grant said, Mr. Clemens, I am not embarrassed. Are you? And that little 7-year smile twinkled across his face again. 17 years have gone by since then, and today, in New York, the streets are a crush of people who are there to honor the remains of the great soldier as they pass to their final resting place under the monument. And the air is heavy with dirges and the boom of artillery, and all the millions of America are thinking of the man who restored the Union and the flag, and gave to democratic government a new lease of life, and, as we may hope and do believe, a permanent place among the beneficent institutions of men. We had one game in the ship which was a good time passer, at least it was at night in the smoking room, when the men were getting freshened up from the day's monotonies and dullnesses. It was the completing of non-complete stories. That is to say, a man would tell all of a story except the finish, then the others would try to supply the ending out of their own invention. When everyone who wanted a chance had it, the man who had introduced the story would give it its original ending, then you could take your choice. Sometimes the new endings turned out to be better than the old one. But the story which called out the most persistent, and determined and ambitious effort was one which had no ending, and so there was nothing to compare the new made endings with. The man who told it said he could furnish the particulars up to a certain point only, because that was as much of the tale as he knew. He had read it in a volume of SKETCHES 25 years ago, and was interrupted before the end was reached. He would give anyone $50 who would finish the story to the satisfaction of a jury, to be appointed by ourselves. We appointed a jury and wrestled with the tale. We invented plenty of endings, but the jury voted them all down. The jury was right. It was a tale which the author of it may possibly have completed satisfactorily, and if he really had that good fortune, I would like to know what the ending was. Any ordinary man will find that the story's strength is in its middle, and that there is apparently no way to transfer it to the close, where of course it ought to be. In substance, the story it was as follows. John Brown, aged 31, good, gentle, bashful, timid, lived in a quiet village in Missouri. He was superintendent of the Presbyterian Sunday School. It was but a humble distinction. Still, it was his only official one, and he was modestly proud of it, and was devoted to its work and its interests. The extreme kindliness of his nature was recognized by all. In fact, people said that he was made entirely out of good impulses and bashfulness, that he could always be counted upon for help when it was needed, and for bashfulness both when it was needed and when it wasn't. Mary Taylor, 23, modest, sweet, winning, and in character and person beautiful, was all in all to him. And he was very nearly all in all to her. She was wavering, his hopes were high. Her mother had been in opposition from the first. But she was wavering too, he could see it. She was being touched by his warm interest in her two charity proteges, and by his contributions toward their support. These were two forlorn and aged sisters who lived in a log hut in a lonely place up a crossroad 4 miles from Mrs. Taylor's farm. One of the sisters was crazy, and sometimes a little violent, but not often. At last the time seemed ripe for a final advance, and Brown gathered his courage together, and resolved to make it. He would take along a contribution of double the usual size, and win the mother over. With her opposition annulled, the rest of the conquest would be sure and prompt. He took to the road in the middle of a placid Sunday afternoon in the soft Missourian summer, and he was equipped properly for his mission. He was clothed all in white linen, with a blue ribbon for a necktie, and he had on dressy tight boots. His horse and buggy were the finest that the livery stable could furnish. The lap robe was of white linen, it was new, and it had a hand-worked border that could not be rivaled in that region for beauty and elaboration. When he was 4 miles out on the lonely road, and was walking his horse over a wooden bridge, his straw hat blew off, and fell in the creek, and floated down and lodged against a bar. He did not quite know what to do. He must have the hat, that was manifest. But how was he to get it? Then he had an idea. The roads were empty, nobody was stirring. Yes, he would risk it. He led the horse to the roadside, and set it to cropping the grass. Then he undressed, and put his clothes in the buggy, petted the horse a moment, to secure its compassion and its loyalty, then hurried to the stream. He swam out and soon at the hat. When he got to the top of the bank, the horse was gone. His legs almost gave way under him. The horse was walking leisurely along the road. Brown trotted after it, saying, "Whoa, whoa, there's a good fellow," but whenever he got near enough to chance a jump for the buggy, the horse quickened its pace a little and defeated him. And so this went on, the naked man perishing with anxiety, and expecting every moment to see people come in sight. He tagged on and on, imploring the horse, beseeching the horse, till he had left a mile behind him, and was closing upon the tailor premises. Then at last he was successful, and got into the buggy. He flung on his shirt, his necktie, and his coat, then reached for, but he was too late. He sat suddenly down and pulled up the lap robe, for he saw someone coming out of the gate, a woman, he thought. He wheeled the horse to the left, and struck briskly up the crossroad. It was perfectly straight, and exposed on both sides, but there were woods and a sharp turn 3 miles ahead, and he was very grateful when he got there. As he passed around the turn, he slowed down to a walk, and reached for his TR, too late again. He had come upon Mrs. Enderby, Mrs. Glossop, Mrs. Taylor, and Mary. They were on foot, and seemed tired and excited. They came at once to the buggy and shook hands, and all spoke at once, and said eagerly and earnestly, how glad they were that he was come, and how fortunate it was. And Mrs. Enderby said, impressively, "It looks like an accident, his coming at such a time, but let no one profane it with such a name. He was sent from on high." They were all moved, and Mrs. Glossop said in an awed voice, "Sarah Enderby, you never said a truer word in your life. This is no accident, it is a special providence. He was sent. He is an angel as truly as ever angel was an angel of deliverance. I say angel, Sarah Enderby, and will have no other word. Don't let anyone ever say to me again that there's no such thing as special providences, for if this isn't one, let them account for it that can." "I know it's so," said Mrs. Taylor, fervently. "Own Brown, I could worship you, I could go down on my knees to you. Didn't something tell you? Didn't you feel that you were sent? I could kiss the hem of your laprobe." He was not able to speak, he was helpless with shame and fright. Mrs. Taylor went on, "Why, just look at it all around, Julia Glossop. Any person can see the hand of Providence in it. Here at noon, what do we see? We see the smoke rising. I speak up and say, that's the old people's cabin afire. Apostrophe didn't I, Julia Glossop? The very words you said, Nancy Taylor. I was as close to you as I am now, and I heard them. You may have said hut instead of cabin, but in substance it's the same. And you were looking pale too." "Pale? I was that pale that if why, you just compare it with this laprobe. Then the next thing I said was, Mary Taylor, tell the hired man to rig up the team, we'll go to the rescue. Apostrophe apostrophe and she said, Mother, don't you know you told him he could drive to see his people and stay over Sunday? Apostrophe apostrophe and it was just so. I declare for it, I had forgotten it. Then, apostrophe said I, we'll go afoot. Apostrophe and go we did. And found Sarah Enderby on the road. And we all went together," said Mrs. Enderby. "And he found the cabin set fire to, and burnt down by the crazy one, and the poor old thing so old and feeble that they couldn't go afoot. And we got them to a shady place, and made them as comfortable as we could, and began to wonder which way to turn to find some way to get them conveyed to Nancy Taylor's house. And I spoke up and said, now what did I say? Didn't I say, Providence will provide? Why sure as you live, so you did. I had forgotten it." "So had I," said Mrs. Glossop and Mrs. Taylor, "but you certainly said it. Now wasn't that remarkable?" "Yes, I said it. And then we went to Mr. Mosley's, 2 miles, and all of them were gone to the camp meeting over on Stony Fork, And then we came all the way back, 2 miles, and then here, another mile, and Providence has provided. You see it yourselves. They gazed at each other awestruck, and lifted their hands and said in Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.